It's time for Power Hour.
Blue 20!
Your number one source for year-round Fighting Irish recruiting news.
Hot rock!
A premium subscription is just a click away at irishsportsdaily.com. And now,
hot!
Your Power Hour host.
He's good.
I love him.
Mike Frank.
All right, folks, welcome once again, everybody, to Irish Sports Daily Power Hour. I'm your host, Mike Frank. We've got a great show lined up for today because one of my favorite people and one of yours as well, Bob Kamel, is going to join the show. And I got kind of a special topic list here that we're going to talk to him about. I put a lot of thought into this before, so I'll explain it once we get into it. But before we get going, and I wanted to mention once again, it's a great time to sign up for irishsportsdaily.com. You can go to the front page of irishsportsdaily.com, click on the subscribe section, and you'll have a chance to sign up for a premium subscription there. Once again, we have Irish Invasion coming up, football camp. There's lots of offers going on. There'll be lots of visits coming up here in the next month or so. And so we expect Notre Dame recruiting to pick up pretty heavily. Also, some decisions coming down the pike. We've had a couple of them on here recently. And so there's a lot to get excited about with Notre Dame football. Go to the front page, sign up today. Also wanted to mention, if you want to advertise with the show, feel free to contact me at mikefrank18@sbcglobal.net. MikeFrank18@sbcglobal.net. Or if you have any questions, you can email me there or stop by The Huddle, which is our free forum on irishsportsdaily.com, and you can ask whatever questions you'd like there. All right, folks, well, we're going to get into it. We're going to bring in Bob Kamel, and before I get going here, I just kind of wanted to explain the format of this. We are lucky enough to have Coach Kamel come in and talk to us, and he's going to be part of the show moving forward, maybe not every show, but certainly a lot of them moving forward. And we have the unique insight into what it's like to coach at this level and what it's like to go through ups and downs and also win at the highest level. He's certainly part of two great programs and working with Bo Schembechler at Michigan and, of course, Lou Holtz here at Notre Dame, and then other coaches around the country as well. So he has a wealth of knowledge. So what I wanted to do was talk to him about his thoughts on maybe some of the things that happened last year, maybe why they happened, what it takes to have a great program. So I want to warn people before we start, Bob, that it may get a little negative at times because in order to talk about the problems, you have to identify the problems, and there were plenty. And so I just want to make sure that people understand from the get-go, this may sound like a negative program, and we're kind of beaten on the negative things, but I think you can offer such really good insight as to what happens and maybe why some of these things happen. So thanks for joining us, as always, Bob.
Well, Mike, it's a pleasure, and a lot of great memories, you and I, from years past. But I have one disclaimer.
Okay.
I did coach for Bo Schembechler, all right? And that was my first coaching job. And so my pedigree goes back to Bo and the things that he did. So before everybody goes online and starts posting about, you know, the vile that they have or whatever you want to say it for Bo, but understand this, and maybe this will smooth things out a little bit. I came here to have the privilege of coaching at Notre Dame, which was a dream for me from the first day I ever coached. I always wanted to be here. And it's ironic, I was able to come to Notre Dame because of Bo. And why I say that is, I had a really strong identification with him. And if you're a young person out in the world right now, I want to give you a warning. Be very, very close to your boss. But if your boss leaves, you're better off to leave with him. And I say that about Bo, and I say that about Coach Holtz. So those 2 years after I was Bo retired basically were miserable for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he warned me that there would be. And then after Coach Holtz left, when Coach Holtz called me in and said, how long do you want to be at Notre Dame? And I said, I want to be at Notre Dame the rest of my life. I never want to leave here, Coach. And I said, there's a reason you're asking me. He said, yes, because I don't think I'm going to be around too much longer. But lo and behold, the same reaction by Bob Davey was the same reaction by Gary Moeller because of the great friendship I had with Coach Holtz. And Joe Moore used to tease me, and he'd say, when is this honeymoon going to be over with you and Lou? But I think the reason Coach Holtz and I had such a great relationship is because Coach Holtz went back to the Woody Hayes days, as did Bo. So the way my pedigree kind of melted right into the two of them, and that's why I had such a great relationship with Coach Holtz.
Well, and it becomes, and we'll talk about some of that stuff here too, it becomes your guys versus their, the old guys' guys, and sometimes there's a holdover and that doesn't work very well, and they kind of clean house later, and so it becomes kind of an old boys network type of situation, and if you're not considered part of that new group, it's tough to really kind of manage your way through that.
One thing I did find out, and I don't want to, you know, talk about myself, but just for the purposes of what we're doing, I did find out after I left or was reassigned by Kevin White that Bob Davey was told by the powers that be at Notre Dame that he had to keep me.
Okay. Well, and that's a good positive.
Well,
plus,
Father really said to me one time, "You're the closest thing we have to a Notre Dame grad on the staff," which was probably one of the hugest honors that anybody could any person could have said to me.
Well, no question, and I think that's a great honor, no doubt. Well, Bob, let's get to some of these questions I have for you. And again, I don't want it to sound overly negative, but I think you have such a unique insight that maybe you could answer some of these and talk about them. You know, one of the comments that Brian Kelly made at the beginning of the year was that after he did some soul searching, Coach, and he talked to some former players, which I know each coach usually does. One of the things that he mentioned was he felt he needed to be around the team more, and it sounded like he was suggesting that he was never really around the morning workouts or any of those types of things. Is that normal behavior for a coach?
Well, the fact is it's not. And I, first of all, let me give Brian Kelly a lot of credit. There are not a lot of people. He'd have to be very confident in himself to actually admit to some of the things that he should have done. Mm-hmm. So I give him a lot of credit for that. But with saying that, the head coach always has to be at the morning workouts. I don't think he has to be the most visible individual on the entire staff. Assistant coaches come and go. Strength coaches come and go. Trainers come and go, on and on. But the head coach has to be that stable individual for everybody to identify with. So the fact is he should have been at those morning workouts, and he mentioned, you know, that he needed to be at those morning workouts. So be around the team more. Interact with the players more, have dinner with the players every now and then, know all the walk-ons' names, stuff like that. All those little things add up. And I don't know if he didn't have to do those things at Cincinnati or at, Central Michigan or Grand Valley State for that matter, but in my background in coaching, the head coaches always did these things. So I feel really good about where he is moving forward. And again, I give him credit for being, you know, very honest, because I think I don't think a lot of people would have done that.
And I agree with you. I think that was very brave for him to say that and admit it. The other thing is, you know, just based off of some conversations I had, Coach, is he talked to some of the departing seniors and essentially admitted as much, you know, saying, "I didn't do a very good job of coaching you guys the last 2 years." I think that that's important, that you have to own up to that. And I think that he did a very good job. And I think that's probably step one of kind of regaining the team's trust and saying, "How can I ask you to invest so much into this program if you don't think that I'm invested as much as well?" And so I think that that's kind of step one.
Well, you know, the other thing he talked about, interviewing the players. Every other head coach that I've been around has interviewed every single player, walk-ons included, after the season, as well as each of the assistants. And the assistant coaches then collaborate with the head coach before the people at their position go in and might say, you know, "I have this, you know, this inside linebacker, Mike Frank, you know, and he's a little bit nervous about having a fifth year, doesn't know if he wants to come back." So then the head coach kind of gets a heads up. Because ultimately, the individual that is the position coach is the one that's ultimately responsible. So if he can pass those things on to the head coach takes notes, and then when the individual player comes in, you know, they can solve the problems and move forward.
It's roster management. You got to know who's coming back and who's happy. And
Mike.
Yeah, it's very, very important. You know, it seems like, Bob, it almost seems like the job kind of overwhelmed Brian Kelly, you know, with the different responsibilities, meaning from, say, Cincinnati to Notre Dame. I mean, do you think that the job is really that much more demanding than what he'd have to do at Cincinnati? I'm just not sure how much more demanding it would be.
Mike, in my heart of hearts, You can name all other 118 Division I football programs. Nothing is, no head coach has more demanding responsibilities. And really, and I say this in all sincerity because I've been around a couple of big-time programs, than the head coach at Notre Dame. I think it was years ago, but Sports Illustrated, I think I have the order right, said the most difficult job and the most high-profile job in all of football is the head coach at Notre Dame. And secondly, it's the quarterback at Notre Dame. And I don't think that that's changed. You know, and again, I'm going to digress a little bit. If a football team goes 1-9 and they beat Notre Dame, 10 years later they have a reunion, they're going to talk about one game.
Sure.
And we can never, ever take that for granted. This is still what we would call a red-letter game for every single team we play, whether we play them at home or whether we play them on the road. And one other comment that I could make, and again, I don't want to – Coach Holtz talked about when – the Notre Dame program started to slip. He said he came into a maintenance mode rather than a continuous progress mode. He went into a maintenance mode, and he blamed himself for that at the time, if you'll recall.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, maybe a little bit of Brian here, Coach Kelly, the same way.
Well, I think after a while you get comfortable in things, you know, and things just get comfortable and things are familiar and you don't necessarily push that envelope. And to be honest, I'm almost 50 years old. You're older. You just a little bit. I'm only going to say just a little bit.
I'm almost 70. Yeah. So.
But my point is, and this might not necessarily pertain to you because you've probably got as much energy as you did, you know, when you were 40. But my point is I think sometimes when you're 35, 40, 45, you just have more energy. You have more drive. You have more passion about things than you do when you're 55 and you're 60 and things like that. And I think it's just, you know, life's experiences. You know, you're worried about, my daughter's, you know, graduating and she's going to be gone. And you know how this is.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You went through this.
Yeah.
You know, you got to worry about weddings and how am I going to pay for this and all these different things. And, you know, that's probably not going through Brian Kelly's mind about how he pays for that. But for every other assistant, it certainly is. I mean, you know, it's not something that if you're not properly motivated, I don't think that this is a job that you can do well. I think you have to have a tremendous amount of drive and desire to do well in this job. And this is a question I really would like to get your thoughts on. Everybody I've ever talked to that says, okay, well, the next guy who gets the job and everybody who has the job before should have, you know, Power 5 conference experience, you know, multiple years head coaching experience in Power 5, should have, you know, multiple years experience coaching and in you know, assistant coaching and all of this type of stuff. And I agree. I think all of that is very important to have if you can get it. But you know how this is. You know, guys that are sitting at a good situation at, say, I'm just trying to think of a position. Say Peterson at Washington. Why would he ever leave Washington for Notre Dame, where he has the program set up exactly like he likes at Washington? Things are on the right trajectory. Everybody likes him. He's a swell guy. Why would he leave Washington, especially knowing how much he likes it out there, for Notre Dame? I almost think that you're better off trying to get a young, hungry guy that has some experience. But, you know, I don't think people realize how hard it is to do this job. I think you need somebody who has experience, but more important, you need somebody who's got a lot of energy. You just, as you mentioned, the responsibilities and the pressure will just wear you down after a while. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, one thing I always refer to when I hear people talk about the head coaching job at Notre Dame, I think in my heart of hearts, and I loved Coach Bo, and I love, you know, Coach Holtz and Coach Pay that I worked for at Northwestern, but I'll say this, and I'll say this unequivocally, as a coach and as a man, I don't think there's an equal in this profession or has been an equal in this profession to Eric Parsegian.
Mm-hmm.
My hero in coaching, the integrity he exudes, the love of his players. I mean, when you get around Eric's guys, it's a fraternity within a fraternity. And one of the things, and I say the great Eric Parsegian, and I mean this, I believe he said, I came to Notre Dame with 12 or 13 years of head coaching experience, and I needed every one of those experiences to be successful at Notre Dame. So I don't know if we could paint it with a broad brush if someone from a Power Five, successful Power Five program would come here. I think Brian Kelly, to be honest with you, I think he had enough experience to come here as the head coach. And if you look at Brian and you talk to Brian, I mean, he's from Central Casting when it comes to being the head football coach at Notre Dame. I don't know this for a fact, but every successful head coach that I've seen has had an individual, whether it be an assistant athletic director, whether it be one of the coaches, whether it be somebody in administration, to handle every single thing, and every now and then to grab Coach Kelly or whatever the coach is and say, Coach, you know what? You need to say no to that group. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to I would walk into Coach Holtz's office. First of all, I'd see his secretary, Jan, and I'd look at her and say, is he in there? And she'd say, yeah. And I'd say, you know, I have to talk to him. And then kind of like I'd maybe make the sign of the cross or cross my fingers or whatever it was, and I'd go in and I'd close the door because I knew that I was going to get ripped. Mm-hmm. I mean, just ripped. Coach, you need to go to Washington to see that. I'm not going to Washington. I don't think we can get that kid. Blah, blah, blah. You're going to go to Hawaii to go see Jason Ching. I coached all the way to Hawaii. Well, Coach, you can take your golf clubs. Oh. But I would go in there knowing that I was going to get ripped. But we had that kind of a relationship that, and it didn't start out that way. Because a couple times when I wanted to see him, especially when I first got here, when I went to talk to him about recruiting, and he kind of looked at me and was like, you know, who are you? But I said, Coach, if we want to get this thing going, so in regard to Brian Kelly, I don't know if he has an individual like that. He may or he may not. But somebody has to be the filter for him, because I can see that Brian Kelly, just by nature, and you talk about Kelly cares and all the great things that he and Pocky do beyond the football. But I think sometimes, some way, in an agreement with Mr. Swarbrick or Father Jenkins, you know, I can't be in 10 places at one time. And my guess is that Coach Kelly and Jack Swarbrick, Mr. Swarbrick, sat down and maybe talked about those things after the season was over.
Yeah, and I don't think he does near as much as what Coach Holtz did, you know, just based off of things. You know, as you know, Coach, you guys used to do that Chicago Alumni Club every year. They haven't done that for years. You know?
They haven't.
No.
They haven't done the Chicago Alumni Club.
No, not for years. Not for years. Yeah, honestly. And, I mean, these are things that they don't do as much of those types of things as they used to do. So, again, I'm not sure it's necessarily that, meaning like, you know, he's got to go do this for this charity or this. He doesn't do as much as that as what you guys did.
Now, remember where Newt Rocking was from.
Yeah.
Before he came from Norway.
Mm-hmm.
Logan Square in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason they call it the Rockne Award.
Sure.
At one time, and some of the listeners that are of my vintage, so to speak, the Rockne Awards was a giant event in Chicago, not only for the alumni, but for high school players.
Sure.
And they would give a little statue. They'd name the Rockne Award winners. And a young man, God, what a recruiting tool that was.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and no offense, look, if you're with the Orange Coast Club of Notre Dame, I've been there. I love you guys. If you're with the New Jersey Club, I love you. I've been there with you guys. You have honored me before above anything. But if there's one that everybody should go to, it's the one 105 miles north and west of here.
Yeah, and like I said, it used to happen all the time, but they don't do that. I don't even remember the last time he's done it. So I think he did it the first year, and I think Charlie was the first to kind of break that tradition. He did it a couple of years and then just didn't do it for a while after that. So I think, obviously, the first year you want to get out there and you know, meet all the people, and then you got to let the guy get down to his job. Now, Coach, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, you've been around a lot of great head coaches. You've been around a lot of guys who've had a lot of success. I mean, what do you think are the personality traits and the intangibles that they all possess? What are the things that make them successful?
Number one, it's a lot of things, but number one for me, being an assistant coach, it's loyalty. You have to exude loyalty, and loyalty must be reciprocal. I saw that with Coach Holtz. I saw that with Bo. I didn't see that with Bob Davey, to be very honest with you. You also have to have a great deal of integrity. The players have to know that you love them. You have to have a work ethic beyond anybody on the staff. The players need to know that. They need to know that the players know who you are, what you're about, and trust. Trust, love, and commitment, Coach Holtz. Those things are you know, really paramount for a head coach. And, you know, when I first came here, when I went to see Coach Holtz and had that meeting, that he kind of looked at me like, what did I bring here?
Yeah.
And I said, Coach Holtz, remember one thing. In recruiting or anything else you do in football here, the pack travels at the speed of the leader of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of looked at me quizzically, and I said, Coach, you have to lead the pack. The speed of the leader of the pack determines the way the rest of the pack will operate. And then about an hour and a half later, he came into the staff meeting, put his book down. He said, fellas, this is how we're going to recruit. And you guys need to understand one thing. The pack travels at the speed of the head, the lead wolf.
Yeah.
And that's me. And I sat there with a big smile on my face. I didn't get it. But, you know, and that, you know, when that precedent has to be set by the head coach. Because if coaches feel that the head coach is not that engaged in recruiting or not that engaged in the mission, well, they slack off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an old saying, so above, so below, when it comes to management. You know, the person that is the people that work for someone are a direct reflection of the individual that's in charge.
You know, Bob, it's interesting you mentioned that. And when you talk to people around the Alabama program, people around the Ohio State program, two hardest working recruiting guys on that staff, Nick Saban, Urban Meyer. And that's just fact.
And that was ditto for Les. And Les was
absolutely. And he worked really hard in recruiting. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. You know, with Urban Meyer, you talk about accountability, and that's what he does. Basically, he has a list and a board. And he has each person's name that they're recruiting on their board. And then the last time they contacted him and actually had a conversation with him, then Urban Meyer will follow up with each one of those guys. Oh, so you talked to Coach so-and-so about this. What did you guys talk about? And that's how he has accountability amongst his staff.
Well, and obviously successful.
It's very, very successful. And you know, I think that... That, you know, if I had to say, is one of the things that I think Brian Kelly needs to be better at is that accountability amongst his staff. I think he's learning that, and I saw last year, before the wheels fell off, he was more committed to working and recruiting than he's ever been since he's been here, which I think was big. And then all of a sudden the wheels fell off, and he had to just put it all the wayside and try and fix the program, fix the season. This year, I see more of him being much more involved than he was, you know. So I like that. But I think the big part is you got to make sure that some guys are accountable. And I'm not sure that he does that enough and should as he should. And I think that that's been one of the issues that he's had. So now, Bob, I want to ask you, because this is important. And a lot of people have asked me this question. And I think it's a valid question. How important do you think having quality assistance is to the success of the team on Saturdays? And the reason I ask this question is because the second question is, how important is it to have, you know, very good recruiting guys? Because you've been around a lot of coaches. You know, some guys may not necessarily be the best position coach, but they're very good recruiters. Other guys are fantastic position coach. Maybe they don't put forth as much effort in recruiting. What's the nice balance? And you can't have there's no staff that has fantastic position coaches and recruiters. Nobody has that. There's only so many really talented players and coaches out there. So I don't think everybody has that. But which is more important to you, do you think?
Well, Mike, you really touched on something that was very important to me. When I came to Notre Dame, I had already been a recruiting coordinator for like 14 years. And one of the things that I learned probably about halfway through those 14 years is exactly what you said. Some guys are going to be better coaches, field coaches. Some guys are going to be better recruiters, okay? What you have to do is you have to come in and analyze each of those people and what their overall contribution is to the football program. Then the next thing that I really changed in my philosophy, because if a guy doesn't want to recruit and the head coach isn't all over him for not recruiting, as a recruiting coordinator, you have no chance. And take it a step further, if I may digress. You can't be a successful recruiting coordinator unless you have the support of the head coach. Because guys will go in there and say, I don't want to recruit this guy, or why is he sending me here, or this or that. Now, a good head coach is going to say, you know what? He's the head coach in charge of recruiting. You can close that door, and you better go see him, because whatever he tells you to do, I'm going to support. Or if you get a head coach who's not as strong, and he's got a guy coming in, the next thing, the recruiting coordinator is called into the office, and like, you know, why are you pushing this guy? Or he does. But here's the answer, okay, to any recruiting coordinator, whether he's at Notre Dame, Michigan, I don't care where he's at. Look at your 9 assistant coaches as a team, okay, as a team. And find roles for them in the recruiting process so that the recruiters that are not strong recruiters, you can put them in a position to have success. I walked into Joe Moore's office. First day I got there, and he looked at me and he said, the first words out of Joe's mouth, he said, "Were you're gonna, somebody told you I'm not a recruiter, that I don't want to recruit." And I said, "Joe, to be honest with you, somebody did tell me that, but I said, I have to tell you this, you're gonna be a great recruiter, okay, because this is what I'm gonna have you do. You are only gonna recruit and visit offensive linemen." And I could still see Joe, I hate to say it, a little cigarette stuck in his mouth. And he went, why didn't somebody else think of that? So I got Joe, and Joe got in step. And mm-hmm. Because, you know, right around the corner from where we're at right now, his first stop was Mike Rosenthal.
Sure.
Okay? And he loved that. And he loved going with those off. And there was no reason for Joe to go across the country and start to recruit a corner. Or Joe to go across the country and start to recruit a quarterback. So you take your entire staff, you analyze your entire staff, you treat them as a team. Some guys are left fielders, some guys are catchers, some guys are shortstops, some guys are designated hitters. So take each of those individuals, analyze those individuals, and put them in a position to be really, really successful. Again, with Joe, when we came on an official visit, when the players came in an official visit, Joe was magic with the mothers and fathers. I mean, he was a guy that dads wanted to hang out with, and he was entertaining. So he had this role where he went from telling me, you heard I didn't recruit, and really I had heard that, but to put him in a position to recruit offensive linemen and then get him to sit at tables with parents, Joe is much of a contribution to that staff from a recruiting standpoint as anybody, including myself, Dave Roberts, Urban Meyer, anybody.
Yeah.
So create a team, go in there, find out the strengths. And the one thing you want to do is put that down on paper and show a plan and take it into the head coach and tell the head coach, you know, hey, you know, this is something that I think is critically important. We had a coach at Michigan who was an iconic offensive line coach, Jerry Hanlon. There was no reason to send Jerry anywhere but Ohio. He'd be more popular there than Kasich.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you could go with Jerry into a school in Cleveland, and the assistant coaches and the principal and the counselor. Hey, Jerry, how are you doing? Go down in Cincinnati. He could have been the mayor of Cincinnati.
Yeah.
But there was no way Jerry needed to go to California. There was no way Jerry needed to go to New Jersey. Jerry had that role, and he was hugely successful in it because he was asserted into that role, and he was from day one. Why put anybody else in Ohio that was on that staff besides Jerry?
Yeah.
So find a spot for your assistants. And find that spot where they can be successful. Now, going back to your first question, how successful of the team on Saturdays? One of the things that I think is really important is you have to agree to disagree, and you can't have thin skin. I mean, if I could just invite every single person that is with us on the air right now to stand on that sideline during a big game, and I'm not talking about standing on the 10-yard line, I'm talking about being right in the mix. It is fast and furious. It's quick. It's so emotional. It's tough. It's all those things. So when you're communicating on the sideline on game day, assistant coaches have to know from the minute we walk on that field, do not take anything personal. Because it's emotional. Then when we come up the tunnel after we've had a big game, all that is forgotten. That's a tough atmosphere to create. But if a head coach can create that atmosphere, I think really it'd become more effective. And you also have, Mike, you have to have the courage of your convictions. you know, you'd be on the headset with Coach Holtz, and I'd be talking about running an off-tackle play, and Dave Roberts would be screaming in my ear that he wants to throw the ball. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I remember one time he snatched the headset off my head. I didn't even know he took it off. He pulled it off so quick and grabbed it and was talking to Dave about not throwing a pass in that situation. And so, you know, that on Saturday's game day, Saturday is when everybody has to pull together and not worry about being criticized.
Yep. It's interesting that you said that. I knew a former coach who coached with Brian Kelly, and I asked him, I said, well, what's it like, you know, working for Coach Kelly? And he said, best guy to work for 6 days out of the week. And I thought that was his thought. You know, it's like, boy, that the last day, of course, being Saturday, was horrible because his personality changes. And as you mentioned, it's emotion and fire, and it's everybody's jobs on the line. And you know, they're getting excited just as the players are. So,
well, yeah, we played Boston College 1 year, and Coach Holtz just ripped one of the assistant coaches. And I'll never forget this. The assistant coach took his headset off, set it on the ground, walked down to the end of the coach's box and stood there with his hands folded for basically the rest of the half of the game. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed him as we were coming off the field. I said, hey, look, this is not going to fly. You can't let that bother you. You know, first of all, there's only two of you that are hearing that. You got to buck up. You got to come up in the second half, put that headset on, because we need you to contribute through the entire game.
Yeah. Yeah, and it can be very vicious. There's no doubt about it. Now, Bob, another thing I wanted to ask you about, because you coach tight ends. You coached alongside Joe Moore, one of the greatest offensive line coaches in the country. Your tight ends blocked well. I mean, they were very, very dominant blockers. You know a lot about offensive line play. You know, it's not that this isn't, you know, you haven't only coached tight ends as well. So you know a lot about it. I mean, the last 4 or 5 years, Notre Dame has had how many first-round draft picks and guys now that on the offensive line projected as potential first-round draft picks? Why is it? I mean, what do you see with this group? Why aren't they more effective? Why can't they get third down and two? You know, why can't they pick up blitz is better? Why it just, you know, Harry seems to do a very good job recruiting. They seem to like him. He has a very similar situation to what Joe had, where he only has to focus on offensive linemen. These kids certainly have talent. They show that in the NFL. They become great players in the NFL. Do you think it's more offense-driven in what they do, or do you think it's maybe he's just not very effective? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you hit a subject that's close to my heart, Peter and Leon, meaning Pete Kraplevich,
sure,
and Leon Walsh. The difference between Peter and Leon when I had them, as well as Danny O'Leary and Mike Denver and Kevin Coretta, Jabari Holloway, was that my guys were probably half tackle, half tight end.
Yeah.
The tight ends right now in this offense have been half tight end and half wide receiver.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And in anything that you do, you achieve what you emphasize. I don't care what aspect of football it is or what aspect of life. You achieve what you emphasize. Now, you mentioned a bunch of guys being first-rounders. The reason that they're first-rounders is because they're being coached by Harry. And I'll say that unequivocally. So, again, you achieve what you emphasize. If you're going to be a football team that we were 3 yards in a cloud of dust, if you will, I hate saying that, but then you're going to become great run blockers. Because that's what you do. You emphasize that. If you're going to be kind of a, you know, a totally passing team, you know, you're going to be pass blockers. And pass blocking is one of the most difficult things to learn. And again, digressing, I would rather have a freshman quarterback than a freshman left tackle. The most difficult transition from the high school game to the college game is in the offensive line. Hands down, nothing is even close. So with that being said, Harry's done a magnificent job of developing guys. But at the same time, he has to be vigilant to what Coach Kelly wants to run with the scheme. So to say that this is all on Harry, it's not.
Sure.
This is basically, not basically, a lot of it is on the scheme. Now, when you talk about picking up blitzes, all right, there's another individual, or sometimes two individuals, that are involved in picking up blitzes also. And they're called halfbacks,
sure,
or tailbacks.
Sure.
Gosh, Mike, remember when there were fullbacks?
Yeah, oh, that was a long time ago. I'd like to see a few of those.
I'd like to see a fullback again.
Yeah.
So if you're in a situation where you're getting blitzed and it's an empty backfield, There's another person that has to account for the blitz, and he's the quarterback.
Quarterback, absolutely.
So if you have no backs in the backfield, the quarterback has to account for the at least for one of the people blitzing. And if you have backs in the backfield, then you have to have those backs have to account for the blitz also. So in my heart of hearts, I can't put this all on Harry's guys. I love Harry. I mean, I'll tell you flat out, I love Harry. Last year, before the clinic, I visited with Harry. I really don't go by the DeGoog that often, but I had a chance to visit with Harry, and we sat in there, and by the time, and I say this in all candor, by the time I left and Harry and I talked, we were both crying.
Yeah.
I mean, we were literally both crying because we were talking about Joe.
Sure.
And I still, to this day, I can't say that I've ever forgot what happened to Joe.
Yeah.
I really can't. I think about it every day. I've tried to flush it from my memory, but when you love a guy like I love Joe, and there's a reason that there's a Joe Moore Award for the best offensive line in the country, and that award is not named after any other offensive line coach. It's named after Joe. Joe was not only a great offensive line coach, he was a developer of men.
Yeah.
And when you talk to these guys, whether it's Aaron, I mean any of them, you talk about Joe, and the conversation about him does bring tears to these guys. And I mean, these are big fellas.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think Harry's probably with Billy Callahan with the Cowboys and Kirk Ferentz, the head coach with Iowa.
Yeah.
Those are probably Joe's biggest disciples, but I can assure you that Harry's right in that lineage, if not Joe's biggest disciple.
Yeah. I think a lot of people blame Harry, and I think part of the problem, as you mentioned, is scheme. And, you know, it's interesting because within this scheme, I'm doing an article right now on Brandon Wimbush and what we should expect, and it's amazing when you look at the numbers how much more effective the quarterback is when they rush for 29 touchdowns on the season versus 18.
Yes.
You know, it's amazing the difference in the productivity of the quarterback, and I think some of it is based off of what do you want to do. Now, granted, you're not always going to be a great running team because you might not have this skill talent or you're young up front or whatever the case may be. But, I think it, as you mentioned, you get what you emphasize, and I think if Brian Kelly's going to fix this, you know, I'm not as old as you, Bob, but I've watched a lot of football, and I'm from the Midwest like you are. The best teams that have had success here in the Midwest for the past 50 years have done two things well. That's they've run the football, and they've been able to stop the run. If you can do those two things, you don't need the skilled talent that a Florida State has. You don't need the skill talent that USC does. I mean, you guys played some great USC teams, beat them left and right, even though they were more talented. And the reason you did it was because you were tougher in the trenches. And that's what I don't think Brian Kelly's understood for the longest time. And it's not just Brian Kelly. I don't think that Charlie Weiss understood that nearly enough. And a lot of coaches have tried to open the passing game up, and I agree. I think you have to throw the football, certainly more than Lou Holtz did in his days. But I think you can still be a good running football team and be able to throw the football as well and be effective at it. And I think as soon as Brian Kelly figures out that you got to be committed to the running game, this offense could be very deadly, especially with a quarterback like Wimbush.
Well, one of the things is I think is when – again, this is my background. I can't speak for Coach Kelly's background, although I do have a great deal of respect, as I mentioned, for him and his background. Inside the 5-yard line, inside the 10-yard line, I want to get the offensive lineman and say, hey, look, this is on you. This is on you. If you and I'm going to run the ball four times, and if we don't score, it's your fault.
Yeah.
Okay? But, you know, I think maybe with the new – I don't know the background – very well of the new coordinator. I know that he came from Memphis. I went to Memphis State University. Still follow the Tigers, and so I'm curious to see if there's going to be a change in that direction. Now, let me tell you. I'm going to give you a little bit. I could tell you stories all day, Mike. But one day we were with Coach Holtz. I think we were playing. It might have been Michigan State, and we were playing in the stadium, and we were. It was the fourth quarter. And Coach Holtz called a timeout. And there was really considering the situation, the down and distance, where we were, the time on the clock, everything and everything else. The assistant coaches from the booth are yelling in my ear, what's he doing? Why did he call a timeout? And I'm like, I don't know. I really don't know. And he called the team off to the sideline, and he said, the offensive lineman, you stay right here with me. Rest of you stand next to Bob right here. And I'm kind of like thinking, like, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what we're going to emphasize here.
Mm-hmm.
He told the offensive lineman, if I look on that field again and I see if it's to the split end side and if I see the right tackle, okay, and only the right tackle, I won't call another timeout. If I see the right tackle and I see the guard is back a little bit and the center's leaning forward a little bit and the left guard is not where, you know, he said, I will call another timeout and I'll burn every timeout until you guys line up. Line up. So I only see one and you play as one. You decide what you want to do. Now get back out on the field. Now I got these guys in the booth are going nuts. You got to be kidding me. I said, hey, we took that ball and Mark Edwards and I don't know if it was Lee Beck then or whoever it was, and or maybe it was A.D. Autry, and we marched that ball right down the field and stuck it in the end zone. But that's how meticulous he was about what he expected. And I really want our listeners to this term here seems so obvious. You can learn so much about a football team. And again, I'm going to say this, and you're going to kind of say, like, what? By the way they line up. It's indicative of probably the rest of the culture of that football team. And when they line up, and you're the right tackle, the next guy on the line of scrimmage is the split end, and all you see is that right tackle, or if it's on the other side of the field, all you see is that tight end, then I'm going to tell you something. You've got a football team that knows how to line up.
Yeah.
And did you ever read the book, The Tipping Point?
Uh-uh.
Where there's certain things in life that you go through, and I can't say, like, well, I'll watch a football game, and I just, like, look at the way that offense lines up, and I'm saying, you know what? This is a well-coached football team because of the way they line up and the way they look.
Are you talking straight line? You want your tackles to be right across from each other, right to the center type
you,
of thing?
When they line up, you just want to see, if you're on the sideline, one guy.
Yeah, because everybody's exactly in the...
Exactly where they need to be, and that's attention to detail.
Yep.
And we called the timeout. He called a timeout. I mean, these guys are screaming. I'm like, I don't know what he's going to do. And all he called a timeout for was he said, you either line up the way you're supposed to line up, and you look like a Notre Dame football team, or I'll burn every timeout, and it's going to be your fault. Bam, we go down the field. And
yeah, sometimes you just got to do things like that.
And I'll be honest with you, Joe wasn't real happy about that, but the result was good.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Now, Coach, we've listened and we've read a lot about the things that Kelly has said since the end of last year. And I think, you know, we both give him a lot of credit because I think he's really addressed a lot of things. A lot of guys probably wouldn't have taken ownership. Maybe they would have privately, but certainly not publicly. The one thing that I will say is he addressed a lot of things in the program, strength and conditioning, certainly a huge need. Offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator. He hired some new coaches. I mean, he's really addressed a lot of things. You know, I made a joke a while ago on this. It's like, well, if you replace your strength and conditioning, your offense, your defense, you know, some other plays, what are you doing well? You know, and I think that that's really what he had to sit there and look at and say, well, what are we doing well? He made wholesale changes at a lot of things. How would you rate that? Do you think that that's a wise thing to do? Just kind of starting over, clean slate on a lot of these situations.
Well, sometimes extreme measures call for extreme changes. I think one of the things that had to be just so difficult for Brian, and I know this kind of secondhand, but Paul Lungo and Coach Van Gorder, they were two of Brian's closest confidants.
Sure.
And that had to be really, really hard. Because we look at it, or as fans, and we say, oh, they fired a strength and conditioning coach, okay? Or they're making a change there. But don't forget, he's got a family. He has a home here, the image and everything else. And the same thing with Coach Van Gorder. That's hard to do, especially with someone that you've been that close to. Some coaches, head coaches, will never hire friends, ever. Because they know that if something goes wrong, you're going to have to fire a friend. And that's hard. So I would say that this had to be hard on Brian, which even makes the decision even more difficult and more personal.
Yeah.
And so I would say that, you know, he felt he had to do these things. And as I read, he had to do these things, not do these things, but a lot of this came as a result of interviewing, you know, all the players.
Yeah.
So, you know, the changes needed to be made. Now, the offensive coordinator, new offensive coordinator, new defensive coordinator, to be really honest with you, candidly honest with you, I don't know enough of their backgrounds to be able to tell you that, you know, one's going to do this or one's going to do that. I was really, really pulling for Mike Elston to be the defensive coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Michigan when Mike played, and if his guys up front play the way he did, I think there'll be a real marked improvement in our defensive line, because Mike is what we used to call a swashbuckler. He was not the biggest guy, not the fastest guy, not the strongest guy, but he's a guy we called a program guy. And he was a guy that came to practice every day as though it were game day. And he's tough. He's a tough, tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely love Mike. And I think he'll do a great job in the position he's in. I think there'll be an improvement there. And again, probably from an emotional standpoint, I would have liked to seen Mike get that defensive coordinator job. But with that being said, he's done a remarkable job. He, Dave Poloquin, Mike Elston, and anybody else in that recruiting office who I don't know, my hat is off to them.
Yeah.
You've got a 4-8 football team, and you've got a lot of change, and you've got a lot of rumors swirling all over. And trust me, people are recruiting against us in a more negative way probably than they ever have. And to overcome all those things with Mike as the lead and Dave Poloquin, the facilitator, my hat is off to both of them. They both should get raises.
Well, they did a fantastic job. And you know how it is too, Bob. When you're 4-8, I shouldn't say you know how it is. It probably didn't go through a lot of 4-8 seasons in your time. But, you know, you're worried about your own situation, you know, because you're like, I don't know whether I'm going to be around here. And so that's a very difficult thing to get people to go out and recruit and do the things that you need them to do. So, and I think in the end, I think if truth be known, I think Mike and Dave and Aaron Carney, you know, those three guys did most of the recruiting that signed the last class because they're, you know, these new guys were just coming in and they had no relationship with them. So I think they did a fantastic job. Now,
one other thing, Mike,
you
mentioned offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator. Brian Pullian is a special team specialist.
Yep.
Okay, I watched him on, I did see some in the spring game. And I think that was a great addition, too.
Yep.
Because if there's one thing that it really is probably, you know, we don't talk about a lot until, you really don't talk about your special teams coach until things go awry.
Yeah.
Then it becomes, field position is so critically important, and that emphasis on special teams, because what happens in special teams, first of all, the special teams coach is always begging the head coach for more time.
Sure.
And the other assistant coaches are like, you know, this is my starting linebacker. I really don't want him on the punt team. This is my starting wide receiver. I really don't want him on the punt return team. So that's a constant battle. And nobody coaches more guys, so to speak, on a daily basis than the special teams coach. And to be a special teams coach, you have to love that. Because in a lot of ways, it's thankless. And in a lot of ways, it's thankless, and especially when something goes wrong.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think that that's the issue, how much time has been given. You know, I think a lot of people want to blame previous coaches as far as, well, this is why we're terrible for special teams, because this guy's a terrible coach. But if you're not given enough time to actually do the job properly, it's hard for anybody to be successful. So,
you know, you talk about changes, Mike. There's changes on coaching staffs for two reasons. Either guys are getting fired or guys are getting better jobs. And by better jobs, I don't think there's a better job than Notre Dame. And you can quote me on that. But maybe it's a chance to be a coordinator. Maybe it's a chance to be a head coach. Maybe it's a chance to move closer to where you're actually from. So if a guy leaves on his own. Quick question. 22 years at Michigan, how many guys did Bo fire?
I don't know.
None.
Yeah.
Continuity is critically important, provided the assistants you have are quality assistants. And then once you lose a guy to become a head coach, you know what? That tells you one thing. I've hired the right guy.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's true, and continuity is a good thing. And you know, we'll talk about staffs and stuff like that. You know, I doubt we're going to get through all these topics today. We'll probably next week have to get through the rest of them. But I do have a lot of questions about chemistry and staff and that, how important that is. And you know, you I'm sure you've got a bunch of stories, both that you can share online and offline about just chemistry and how important that is. And we'll get to some of those, but I wanted to get back to the topic of the changes. And again, you didn't go through a lot of programs where they didn't have a lot of success. Do you ever remember being in a situation where a head coach made this many changes, and did he have success afterwards by making so many? Because every time I've ever seen it happen, it hasn't turned out to be successful. That doesn't mean it won't or it can't. It's just it doesn't usually end up that way, at least in my experience of following Notre Dame. What's been your experience in all of this?
Well, Mike, the only time, how can I say this? The incumbent head coach, I've never been around an incumbent head coach that has had so many staff changes. Never. Now, when there's a head coaching change,
sure,
you can expect changes. But I actually have never been around an incumbent head coach that has made this many changes. And so to tell you that I could answer this question from an experience standpoint, I really can't. But I will tell you that I've seen a head coach where there's been a change of a head. I've been in three changes of head coaches, four, and I've always been retained. So I've been really blessed.
Yeah.
But what happens is, especially if the new head coach is on the staff, and he becomes the head coach, he has relationships with assistant coaches on that staff that are his peers. And he's not going to like all them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when personalities come into it.
Mm-hmm.
So a new head coach coming in is probably going to, you know, make changes based on more things than an incumbent coach would do.
Sure.
Because you're his peer. You're with them. You're at the hotel with them. You're recruiting with them somewhere. And everybody's not always going to get along.
Sure.
So in that case, I could see a lot more changes than when there's an incumbent head coach.
Yeah. It just seems interesting because, when you look at all the changes that have been made, Bob, they all look like on paper they'd be a good thing. You and I are big fans of Mike Denbrock because personally he's a tremendous guy. I think he could be a fantastic head coach someday. I think he knows offense. I think he's a very good position coach. But when you have Mike Sanford, Mike Denbrock, and Brian Kelly arguing about what they want to do offensively, that's never going to be a good situation. It should have never happened where you had an offensive coordinator who was basically offensive coordinator in name only, and then another guy who was the former offensive coordinator actually being the offensive coordinator, drawing up the game plans, calling the plays, until a point where the head coach then gets upset and he starts getting involved in the offense, and it just is a disaster, a recipe for disaster. So as much as we like some of those guys, and Mike Sanford was a good guy, if Brian Kelly allows Chuck Long to be the offensive coordinator, call all the plays, and then he stays out of it, as good of coaches as all three of those guys are, that's a better situation for Notre Dame. With Brian Van Gorder being out, I think he was a very good scheme guy. There's no question he knew what he was doing scheme-wise, but does Notre Dame have enough time to actually implement all the things that he wants to do? And I think that was a big problem for it. You have Elko, who was extremely successful with a lot less talent than what he would have here. That seems like a positive. We mentioned Brian Polian, who is a very good special teams coordinator and a fantastic recruiter on top of that, yes. Knows this situation better than anybody else coming in, has head coaching experience. That certainly seems like a big plus. You've got rave returns on what we've seen so far in strength and conditioning. They hired a new guy who's going to bring more science into it. That looks like a plus. So you look at all this on positive or on paper, and everything looks positive. But again, I just have never seen it actually work out that way. I'm really anxious to see it work because I think it could work.
I
do.
I think it can work also.
Yeah.
Three things, okay? As far as strength and conditioning goes, I never even went walked into the strength and conditioning room. I mean, I had so much more to do.
In your shape, you can't believe it.
I still run 3 miles every night.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you're looking fantastic for your age.
But I never really did because I knew that I didn't know the science of strength and conditioning.
Sure.
And that aspect of the program developed through my tenure as a coach. I mean, I think back to the early years when I first started coaching and that to where this is at right now with nutrition and individual, you know, all those things. So I can't speak to Paul Lungo.
Mm-hmm.
I've met him a couple times. He's been cordial. I agree totally with you about Mike Denbrock. I absolutely respect Mike Denbrock. Again, as a coach, as a man, as a father, as a husband, on and on. Mike Denbrock's as good as they come in this profession. He exudes integrity. I was sorry to see that happen, but at the same time, I'm not in those staff meetings, so I don't know what happened. You make a great point about Brian Van Gorder. There are two aspects in defense and offense, but two aspects, since we're talking about defense, that are critically important. One is scheme, as you mentioned, Coach Van Gorder, and the other one's technique. The scheme was very complicated as I watched it, okay? And again, I'm not, who am I to judge? Brian Van Gorder has a phenomenal resume, but the scheme appeared to me very complex. What we lacked defensively was technique. And if I could have a football player that is not as efficient in the scheme, but is a great technician, technique. Technique is the most important aspect. Scheme is what we do. Technique is how we do it. Where do you put your hand when you're a defensive lineman in a certain defensive call? Where do you place that hand at a defender? Okay, how do you bring your legs? What is your, you know, are you a flat back? Are you whatever it might be. Every little single nuance of what you do is called technique. You can't be a great football player unless you're a great technician. If you're a good football player and you are a good technician, you'll become a great technician. If you're an average football player and you're a great technician, you will become a good football player. So what I saw from defensively is there was probably a lot more time spent on scheme than there was technique.
Mm-hmm.
And the technique has to come from a great deal of onus put on the assistant coaches to coach technique. You have to have your own meeting. You can't constantly meet as an entire defense. You have to get into that defensive meeting and spend as much time, if not more, on technique than you do on scheme.
Yeah.
I thought watching the spring game this year as much as I did, I thought a lot of the techniques were improved.
Yeah. Now, I think that's what you're going to see a big difference between Elko and Elston Van Gorder is that, they're just going to tackle better. They're going to do the little things that make you be successful. And it's interesting because, like, when Bobby Diaco came here, right, we didn't know what to expect. But they had a huge jump. The very first year he was here, and the reason why, technique. They didn't have a lot to worry about.
What was his pedigree?
Yeah, well, played with Iowa. Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Hayden Fry, right there, absolutely. Right. You know, and it was all about that, you know. And because of that, they were able to make significant jumps because they simplified a lot of things and they just said, here's how you tackle somebody, okay? Here's how you hit somebody. Here's as you mentioned, here's how you pass rush. Here's how you do these things. You take less responsibility in thinking out of the game and you let them become athletes. And I think that was the biggest problem with Van Gorder. And so that's why I'm excited about Elko, because I think he's kind of dumbed down everything. It's not near as complicated. And now you'll let athletes be athletes. And if you can let athletes be athletes against teams like Temple, you should win those games because you have better athletes. And they're not worried about scheme and things that slow them down and take away their athleticism because they're thinking so much. So that's what I'm excited about, and I'm really excited to see how these changes materialize.
I think that was very well put, Mike. Yeah. I really do. Let athletes be athletes. And, mm-hmm. and that, again, if you've got a great athlete and he's a great technician, you're going to have a great football player.
Well, Bob, I think that's about all we have time for today. First of all, thanks, man. This is great. People are going to love this. And so next week, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about some of these other things. We're going to talk about the recruiting aspect of things. And one thing that I really want to get your insight on is the academic situation.
How much time do you have?
Yeah, well, and that's where, I mean, that's where I think you can bring a perspective that nobody knows.
I'm going to throw this out, though.
Yeah,
okay?
Go ahead.
All right, remember this as we go to next week. The most important academic person in a player's life starts with his being with his position coach. And then I'll move forward next week.
All right. We're going to talk about that. Folks, I hope you enjoyed that. And once again, we'll have Bob on next week. I can't wait to get more into this because we got a whole lot of questions here that I still want to get to, and I'm excited about it. Hope you enjoyed that. We will be back on Thursday. We're going to have a recruiting power hour as well. So we have a guy lined up. Don't want to mention just yet because I want to make sure we have it completely finalized, but we got a guy lined up for recruiting power hour. We're going to talk to him on Thursday, and then we'll be back on Monday once again with our power hour and Bob Kamel. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to Power Hour, presented by IrishSportsDaily.com, where you can sign up for a premium subscription. Follow the Fighting Irish throughout the year on Twitter as well at ISD Update. And to listen to archive shows, visit iTunes and search for Notre Dame Power Hour.